Welcome to this week's Digest edition of the Herald Scotland, from the 26th of January to the 1st of February 2018. Read by volunteers at Cune Review Print Speaking for the Blind at our studios in the Bishopriggs Media Centre. Coming up on Side 1.
Scots law giant Burness Paul link to hundreds of secretive shell firms.
Board members resign from Creative Scotland over funding furore.
Scottish Labour unveils alternative budget proposals.
Orange ordered to launch charm offensive in response to negative media coverage.
Scots pain and suffering, the cause of addiction, obesity and self-harm, expert claims. Ecstasy suspected to have caused three to fall ill at DJ's gig at Glasgow's O2 Academy.
The Marianne Taylor column. Island economics will eventually defeat the Sabbatarians.
Why I doubt women will achieve real equality anytime soon.
Agenda. The fight against climate change begins at home.
Poem of the day. New by Rebecca Pine.
Theatre review. Bold girls at Citizens Theatre, Glasgow. This article from the Herald on Monday the 29th of January 2018. News. Scots law giant Burness Paul link to hundreds of secretive shell firms. This article by David Leask. Hundreds of shell companies based at one of Scotland's biggest law firms have flouted anti-money laundering laws, the Herald can reveal. The Scottish Limited Partnerships, or SLPs, all legitimate investment vehicles formerly headquartered at the Edinburgh offices of legal giants Burness Paul, have failed to meet key transparency rules. They were supposed to name their controllers under a new openness requirements imposed last summer after hundreds of other SLPs were exposed as key fronts for organised crime and corruption, especially in the former Soviet Union. Their failure to do so comes amid serious political concern about the robustness of Britain's anti-money laundering regime, and especially the rule under which firms, including SLPs, have to name a person of significant control, or PSC, if they have one. Politicians stress that legitimate SLPs, usually used for tax-efficient equity funds investments, are just as obliged to comply with the rules as those with entirely opaque offshore structures, most likely to be used for money laundering. Burness Paul is the biggest host of SLPs used in the equity funds industry, but is not legally responsible for what its client firms do. The Herald has analysed filings at Britain's Corporate Registry, Companies House, form some 2,500 SLPs registered at Burness Paul's address in the capital's Lothian Road. We were only able to locate full PSC statements from one in three of them. Just under 1,000 said they had a person of significant control, but were yet to name them. We found at least 342 SLPs, which were, as of this week, legally active, but which had made no attempt to file any statement. Burness Paul said it was helping some of its clients to meet the regulations introduced to enable to the UK to comply with EU-wide anti-money laundering directive, but that it was not responsible for any SLP which decided not to accept that assistance. There is no suggestion that Burness Paul itself has breached money laundering regulations or any other laws or professional practice rules. The law firm says its funds team operates with integrity and professionalism. SNP MP Alison Thewlis has been campaigning for tougher transparency rules and for further reforms of SLPs, despite concerns from legal firms, including Burness Paul, that a crackdown on the abuse of corporate entity could threaten their equity funds business. Ms. Thewlis said, "There are serious issues with the accountability and transparency of SLPs. While there may well be legitimate use of SLPs, there is very little being done to ensure they are compliant with the law. Corporate law is reserved. Ms. Thewlis and the SNP wants to see powers at Britain's Companies House beefed up so officials can ensure that SLPs are not abused," she said. "It is undeniable that the current processes employed by Companies House are deficient and are failing to improve transparency with respect to SLPs. Companies House clearly does not have the resources to keep tabs on SLPs. SLPs have played key roles in multi-billion dollar money laundering schemes such as the Russian and Azerbaijani laundromat. Because they have legal personality, SLPs can enter into contracts and own assets on their own behalf, despite having no named owners. And their anonymity has made them hugely popular, especially in Ukraine and Russia, where they were advertised off the peg as Scottish zero-tax offshore companies. The Herald has already exposed the mass PSC non-compliance by SLPs with the most opaque ownership. Such partnerships have partners which are equally opaque corporate entities in secret jurisdictions such as Belize or Panama. These Caribbean partners are in turn controlled, often using powers of attorney, by unknown figures elsewhere in the world. The kind of legitimate firms hosted by Burness Paul are more likely to have partners in the Channel Islands set up using tax-efficient structures. Burness Paul on its website warns that it is a criminal offence not to comply with PSC regulations, even though doing so undoubtedly involves a degree of inconvenience. In a statement to the Herald, its partner, Paula Kennedy, said she was aware of reports that SLPs were being used for apparently unknown purposes, but that that was not an area in which Burness Paul operates. She added, "There is a significant and legitimate use of SLPs. Our fund's practice is engaged in the formation and operation of SLPs in private equity and other private fund structures. We believe a significant contribution has been made by private equity, venture capital and other such firms to the UK economy through the investment in and growth of UK and international businesses, and the use of SLPs and their English equivalents have been an essential part of that model." Miss Kennedy stressed that this business was regulated and said Burness Paul was diligent in carrying out all necessary checks for clients as required by law and in accordance with our strict internal policies. She added, "We proactively advised our SLP clients about the introduction of the PSC regime and the duties and obligations of those clients under the regime. When instructed to do so, we work with SLP clients to help them satisfy their PSC obligations, and this work continues. A number of clients choose to deal with these requirements internally or perhaps use other service providers, as is their right." The UK government, which is still considering whether further reforms of SLPs are needed, said Companies House was in the process of chasing up all such firms which had failed to name a PSC. A spokesman for the Department of Business, Energy and Industry Strategy, which is responsible for Companies Houses, said, "The UK has one of the most transparent and accessible company registers in the world, viewed 2 billion times last year, helping investors choose how best to manage their funds and supporting law enforcement agencies in money laundering investigations. When irregularities are identified, Companies House takes action and is contacting all non-compliant SLPs to ensure they adhere to the new transparency requirements. When SLPs choose to ignore these requirements, information is passed to the relevant agencies, which can lead to prosecutions." This article by David Leask.
The Herald Scotland, Thursday, 1st February 2018. Board members resign from Creative Scotland over funding furore, by Phil Miller. Two board members have resigned from Creative Scotland amid growing controversy over its funding decisions. Ruth Wishart and Professor Maggie Kinloch have stepped down from the body's board, which is due to hold an emergency meeting over the furore surrounding its regularly funded organisation's decisions. Ms Wishart said it is dispiriting that Creative Scotland again finds itself a family at war with many of those it seeks to serve. There has been anger over cuts to touring theatre organisations such as Catherine Wheels and the disability theatre company Birds of Paradise. They have both resigned with immediate effect. The arts body has been forced to hold crisis talks to review its funding decisions. An emergency board meeting is to be held within days to take stock of the fallout from moves to strip 20 companies of long-term funding. In a blog entry today, Ms Wishart, an experienced journalist, writes, "It's not possible to go into the discussions at the relevant board meeting, not least since, whilst you serve on board, you are bound by the equivalent of collective cabinet responsibility. That is a perfectly sound principle. It also, however, causes you to reflect as to whether you can continue to back what you believe to be a flawed decision. In the light of the furore over the RFOs, the board is due to meet again tomorrow to examine again the executive's conclusions on regular funding. Both its remaining members and the executive are acutely aware of how important it is to be responsive to genuine concerns, and I believe they will be. When all this blew up, I was bemused to read one critic suggest that the board was stuffed with consultants. In fact, there is a very wide range of experience of the arts around the table, including people who are practising artists as well as those from the arts education sector. They come to their Creative Scotland role as unpaid volunteers with sufficient passion for Scotland's culture to offer their time and talents. Nobody on the board joined to become a saboteur. Similarly, the organisation itself boasts people with enormous commitments to the arts community. They have endured a very turbulent few months.
Article from Herald Scotland, 30th of January 2018. News. Scottish Labour unveils alternative budget proposals. By Alistair Grant, political correspondent. Scottish Labour has outlined plans to pump nearly £1 billion into Scotland's economy in what it calls the most radical set of fiscal policies ever to be presented at Holyrood. The party's alternative budget proposals include an extra £100 million for the NHS, a fully funded public sector pay rise, and the introduction of a 50p top rate of income tax. It comes ahead of the first vote on the SNP's draft budget plans tomorrow, which will need to secure the support of at least one other party to pass. But critics branded Labour's plans last minute, while the Scottish Government dismissed them as fantasy figures riddled with factual blunders. Labour insisted its proposals demonstrated a radical alternative to the SNP's tinkering around the edges and will now seek to build support in Holyrood. Leader Richard Leonard said it was time to end the failed experiment of austerity by making radical use of the powers available to the Scottish Parliament. He added, "When we campaigned for a Scottish Parliament, we saw it as a bulwark against Tory austerity, but in recent years it has simply been a conveyor belt for cuts. That needs to end." Labour's alternative income tax plan matches the Scottish Government's starter rate of 19 pence, but places the income threshold for a 45 pence rate at over £60,000 and introduces a new 50 pence top rate for those earning over £100,000. The SNP's draft budget would see a 46 pence rate only kicking in for earnings over £150,000. Both the SNP and Labour proposals would mean those earning above £33,000 paying more tax than they do now. Labour also called for increased economic powers to be handed over to local authorities, enabling them to charge a tourist tax on each hotel night per person, potentially raising £70 million a year. Edinburgh Council, which is run by an SNP-Labour coalition, is already advancing its own case for a similar levy. A land value tax, meanwhile, would allow councils to tax more than 10,000 hectares of vacant, economically inactive land, while a proposed social responsibility levy would apply to alcohol sales in licensed premises. Labour said its plans would also fund a pay increase for local government workers, addressing a key criticism of the SNP's proposals. But the Greens, widely seen as the most likely to support the SNP's budget, blasted Scottish Labour's plans for arriving a day before the first budget vote. And Scottish Liberal Democrats leader Willie Rennie, who could also throw his support behind the SNP if certain demands are met, said there was a whiff of wishful thinking to the proposals. Finance Secretary Derek Mackay branded Labour's vision a wish list scribbled on the back of a fag packet.
The Herald Scotland, Thursday, 1st February 2018. Orange ordered to launch charm offensive in response to negative media coverage. Exclusive by Tom Gordon, Scottish political editor. The Orange Order has announced it is to launch a charm offensive to challenge its perception in the media and showcase the organisation to the public. The ultra-unionist Protestant Christian Fraternity has declared 2018 a year of opportunity and intends to capitalise on an international gathering in Edinburgh in the summer. It has also said there will be a major indoor event in the autumn to showcase the institution to the membership and to the general public. The PR plan is described in the latest issue of The Torch, which calls itself the official journal of the Loyal Orange Institution of Scotland. It says the Orange Order has entered the new year with a spring in its step, as it will have the honour of hosting the 46th Triennial Conference of the Imperial Orange Council. The Council will convene in the first week of July in a hotel next to the Scottish Parliament. The Torch says exotic visitors will come from countries including Ghana, Togo, the USA, Australia, Canada and New Zealand. Many of the guests are expected to attend celebrations of the 1690 Battle of the Boyne. In a separate spring event, the Order will discuss its coverage in the media, which is often connected to sectarianism and violence and intimidation linked to Orange Walks. Recent controversies include photos from a fancy dress party at an Orange Order hall showing people dressed as Nazis, Holocaust victims and Catholic clergy. The Torch sees the baleful attitude of much of the Scottish media towards the Order and how to tackle it will form the basis of a media and public relations seminar in the spring. The event is expected to take the form of a How Others See Us forum, led by a professional PR consultant. It will be a hotel-based all-day conference for officers of Grand Lodge, County Grand Lodge and other leading figures. The Torch goes on. Autumn's major event will utilise a spacious indoor conference centre to showcase the institution to the membership and to the general public. It is anticipated there will be static displays, promotional stalls and a rolling programme of guest speakers and a big screen feature on the Order's many activities. The Grand Master intends 2018 to be a positive year for the institution at every level. Let's see what can be done to make it happen. The last time the Orange Order attempted a high-profile PR event, Orange Fest in Glasgow's George Square in 2015, around 30,000 people signed an online petition against sectarian, hate-filled Orange marches. David Scott, campaign director of Nil by Mouth, Scotland's leading anti-sectarian charity, gave the Order's initiative a cautious welcome, but said its image had been ingrained over decades and could not be turned around by a few slick press releases or a PR makeover. He said it is good that the Order recognises it has to explain itself more and tell people what they're about. If they want Nil by Mouth to come to their event and tell them about how they are perceived, then I would be happy to do that. But the Orange Order's problems go a lot deeper than public relations. Their membership is dwindling, and there are centuries of history involved. It's a massive mountain to climb. The Orange Order is one of the fiercest critics of Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP, and was a registered no campaigner in the 2014 referendum. On the eve of the ballot, it organised the biggest event held by either side in the campaign, bringing 15,000 people to a no rally in Edinburgh under the banner British Together. The Grand Orange Lodge of Scotland declined to comment.
This article is from the Herald, Wednesday, 31st January. News. Scots' pain and suffering, the cause of addiction, obesity and self-harm. Expert Claims, by Stephen Naismith. Addicts in Scotland turn to drink and drugs because of the pain and distress in our culture, a leading recovery worker has claimed. But Dharma Karnini Kuladharini, chief executive of the Scottish Recovery Consortium, said attempts to prevent drink and drug use alone would not solve the malaise. Scotland's obesity epidemic, high rates of suicide and smoking were all similar symptoms caused by Scots facing huge amounts of pressure, she said. We can focus on drug problems, but double the number of people are dying from alcohol, and more again are dying from suicide as well. It's like whack-a-mole. You tackle one problem and another pops up. Kuladharini describes those who are addicted, self-harming, smoking, depressed or obese, as the canaries in the mine. We are telling you there is something invisible but toxic in the atmosphere. The canaries are giving the whole community in the mine the chance to save their lives, she said. We have lost sight of what it means to be human, and our values are economic ones, not human ones. Speaking to MSPs on the Health and Sport Committee at Holyrood, which is investigating how to prevent health problems. She said better computer systems or targets for recovery were not likely to help. It is looking for a technical fix when what we need is a paradigm shift. People are in pain and they are likely to be using drugs to stop their discomfort and pain. Drugs like alcohol, suicide and obesity are a symptom of the distress in our culture, and we need to tackle that in a much more proactive way, she said. Kula Dharini claims the causes of the pain include rapid changes in the economy, fear and stress, insecure employment and housing, family breakup, fragmented communities and the loss of local services. Government is not to blame, but is part of the solution along with the media, churches and communities, she added. Other leading addiction charities backed her comments and warned that stigma and hopelessness are hampering efforts to treat those dependent on drink or drugs. David Liddle, director of Scottish Drugs Forum, said stigma meant many people have viewed addiction as a lifestyle choice rather than face the fact that people with serious problems are using drugs to mask the symptoms of the problems they face. Andrew Horn, director of Addaction, said people were sent to prison at great cost rather than helping them. We need to invest to save, he said. Fiona Moss of the Glasgow City Alcohol and Drug Partnership said services needed to be better equipped to deal with the problems underlying someone's addiction. People who support those with addictions need to be aware of trauma. If you don't address it, you won't see it and you can't investigate it, she said. Meanwhile, Greg Sayers, Scottish representative of the Royal College of General Practitioners, said many drug users were leaving prison at risk of overdose and without their drug problems being addressed, and too often without housing or access to a GP. Short sentences lead to an increased risk of overdose, but don't allow any chance of meaningful work with them, he said. This article is from the Herald, Wednesday, 31st January, news. Ecstasy suspected to have caused three to fall ill at DJ's gig at Glasgow's O2 Academy, by Stephen Naismith. Three people, including two teenagers, have been taken to a hospital after falling ill at a concert in Glasgow, apparently as a result of taking ecstasy. Police said they were investigating after a 20-year-old man fell ill at a gig at the city's O2 Academy at around 11 p.m. last night. After police and an ambulance were called to the venue, where Electro House DJ Steve Aoki was performing, a boy and girl, both aged 16, also became unwell. Police say MDMA, commonly known as ecstasy, was a possible cause. All three were taken to the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital, where the condition of two of the patients was reported by staff to be giving cause for concern. In a statement, Police Scotland said the 16-year-old girl remained stable and had been detained overnight for observations. A spokeswoman said inquiries are ongoing to establish circumstances surrounding each person taking unwell. One line of inquiry is that each may have taken a type of MDMA that has still to be confirmed. None of those involved are known to each other. Anyone else who attended the event and felt ill, regardless of whether they have taken illegal drugs, is urged to seek medical attention.
Remember, you no longer need to receive a weekly digest service on tape, but can in fact listen to more daily content online via www.qandreview.com/freepodcasts, accessible on your computer or mobile device.
The Herald, Monday, January 29th, the Marianne Taylor column. Island economics will eventually defeat the Sabbatarians. A picture is so often worth a thousand words. And so it was yesterday with the photo that summed up the latest turn in the saga over Sunday opening on the Isle of Lewis. On the left stands the stony-faced protester, an elderly church minister dressed in a flat cap and sober grey coat, holding a homemade sign emblazoned with one of the Ten Commandments. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Next to him is a bearded young man wearing skinny jeans, a leather jacket, a Star Wars t-shirt, and just the hint of a smile. The hipster has come to Stornoway's Arts Centre, An Alachta, to see the latest Star Wars film. The churchman is protesting the fact that he is able to do so on a Sunday. Those who have been following the centre's controversial decision to show films on a Sunday in the face of opposition from Sabbatarian church leaders will know that things have become heated over the last few weeks. Those against the move, many of whom are members of the Free Church, have accused the Arts Centre of allowing their board to be hijacked by secularists with an axe to grind and forcing staff to work on Sundays against their will. An Lantia, which is owned and run by members, has always denied such accusations, saying its decision was based on consultation with the community that showed a significant majority in support of Sunday opening, with the chairman telling the BBC the board would be led by demand following a trial period. Yesterday's showing of Star Wars was sold out, and it will be interesting to see whether future features prove as popular. You get the feeling there's no going back on this one, however, and according to the Sabbatarians, that's clearly a win for the dark side. Those who live in Scotland's last remaining bastion of hardline Presbyterianism are well used to rehearsing the arguments around Sunday opening issue, of course. For many years, debate raged about whether public transport should run, and you can now get either a flight or a ferry in and out of Lewes on the Sabbath, much to the chagrin of the Free Church. But many other services and businesses on both Lewes and Harris remain shut on Sundays, including the council-run leisure centre, as well as a vast majority of shops and restaurants. Only a few weeks ago, a fresh row broke out when a businesswoman in Stornoway opened her tweed shop on a Sunday and was sent a Bible and Honour the Sabbath letter by the Lord's Day Observance Society. Scotland, it seems, is playing out its very own little culture war on a remote and windy archipelago out in the Atlantic Ocean. Despite my secularist leanings, however, I can genuinely see both sides of the argument on this one. As a regular visitor to the Western Isles, like most folk, I am seduced by the white sandy beaches and vast lonely moors, the mountains, hills and lochs, the magnificent wildlife. But what also draws me back are the people of these islands, natives and incomers alike, striving so hard to keep communities afloat and traditions alive, often against harsh economic and environmental realities. One of the other things that makes Lewes and Harris special is the fact that Sunday genuinely feels different whether you are religious or not. It is refreshing to be somewhere where the decision on whether to go and do the big shop at Tesco is taken out of your hands, where commercialism takes second place, at least for one day in seven. That said, it can be hard to understand how going for a swim, seeing a film, or even enjoying a meal out with your family on a Sunday could be viewed as the work of the devil. But regardless of your view, ultimately, in this age of individual freedom and choice, the hardline argument of the Sabbatarians has nowhere left to go, and soon it will be brought down by two forces, reason and economics. Simple logic will win the day. If you don't want to go to a cinema on a Sunday, then don't. If you choose not to use a ferry on a Sunday, that's entirely up to you. Rural economics will also play an increasingly important role in this debate, as all our island communities know only too well. Depopulation has long been a reality for Lewis and Harris. Indeed, the abandoned settlements and houses you see all over the Outer Hebrides tells a traumatic tale of loss. But with increasing numbers of people from urban areas looking for a different type of life, and industries such as tourism and green energy replacing old, unsustainable ways of life, the Western Isles has a genuine opportunity to survive and thrive, but only if it continues to evolve. Take a walk around Stornoway or Tarbert, and you are as likely to hear voices from Glasgow, Gloucester and Gdansk as the Gaelic tongue. That's another reality. And as the number of incomers visiting and making their lives on the islands grow, the push for more Sunday opening from locals and incomers alike will become untenable. The sky will not fall in, though new tales of loss may be told. At least there will be someone to tell them to.
This article is from the Herald, Wednesday, 31st January. Opinion. Why I Doubt Women Will Achieve Real Equality Anytime Soon, by Rosemary Goring. The BBC's report on the gender pay gap has been widely anticipated, though not always for the right reasons, as the pay scales and discrepancies of this behemoth are pored over. Ordinary employers' pulses will be doing double quick time as they dread a copycat revolution in their own ranks. At the Beeb, meanwhile, confirmation that certain male colleagues have been earning more than their female peers promises to make Broadcasting House an unhappy place. Yet long before the report's comprehensive analysis was made public, many women in the corporation were sceptical about whatever evidence it produced, nor were they being paranoid. The salaries department might not have a deliberate agenda or policy with regard to women's remuneration, nor intentionally obfuscate almost a century of undervaluing their contribution. Nevertheless, bald statistics will never tell the whole story. Whether inequalities are laid bare, you can be confident that beneath them lies a more insidious, invisible, and perhaps even unconscious chasm. Several BBC journalists have pointed out, for instance, that while salaries might appear comparable for both sexes, there is often a shocking lack of parity in terms and conditions and benefits. Thus, as I have suggested before, despite the likes of John Humphreys nobly taking a pay cut to help recalibrate the scales, winning a few high-profile scalps doesn't begin to address the problem. Indeed, in some way, it confuses it. That's because the biggest issue is not really the minutiae of who is paid, what and why, even though that makes headlines. In broadcasting, some egregious differences can reasonably be explained by experience and specialism, or rare and valuable attributes. In simple terms, audience pulling power. The same is true in almost every workplace that requires a creative element, be it in theatre, film or advertising. Crudely put, some individuals are worth more to a company because of the profits or glory they attract. Of course, there is a highly subjective element to assessing who is better or more important than others, but such distinctions are nevertheless inevitable and not always invidious. Where the issue becomes thorny, highlighting ancient prejudice, is when time and time again women are deemed lesser, as one after another fails to make promotion or is kept figuratively in the back office. You realise that the very definition of talent by which the BBC and other employers work is flawed. Talent becomes a description like managing director or explorer or concert pianist that is still overwhelmingly associated with men. No matter what realm we are thinking of, apparently women are seen as inferior. And before any of us thinks that the blame lies squarely with men, a documentary on Radio 4 pointed out earlier this week that women are just as guilty of this mindset, sometimes more so. As Mary Ann Seacart's programme uncovered, the primitive part of the brain processes what it observes rather than what it wants to or has been taught to believe. So when thinking of people in positions of authority, or picturing someone who looks after children, old-fashioned views of men's and women's capabilities still dominate. Men in the serious, prestigious, influential roles, and women on the middle and lower rungs. Hence the need for imaginative initiatives. One such is our bid to become the first part of the UK to legislate that at least half the board members of public authorities are female. Now, you can scoff at tokenism, or complain about special pleading, or rail against political correctness, but the facts are stark. Until women are as visible in the top echelons of business, medicine, higher education, agriculture, the law, name whatever line of work you like, and the chances are we still have a long way to go, the very notion of equality is doomed, if not to failure, then to falling short. I find it distressing, not to say angering, to think that young women starting out in their careers today, in supposedly enlightened times, are at the same psychological and social disadvantage as their great-grandmothers. From the days they lay chortling in their pram, the lesser ability of their gender has been made clear to them in a million small ways, by their family, teachers, friends. These women may look sophisticated and self-confident, but beneath the surface they are woefully unsure of their right to be ambitious and successful on their own terms. When a novel stands more chance of being picked up by a literary agent if the author is male, when maternity leave is considered the end of a career or a drain on an employer's bet profits, when asserting oneself in a meeting or asking for a pay rise leads to accusations of who does she think she is, then equality is but a pipe dream. No doubt, a chastened BBC will try to mend its ways and set an example. Until the rest of society has overwritten aeons of prejudice and discrimination, however, real, meaningful change, whether in one's pay packet or in public attitudes, simply cannot happen. Not in my lifetime is my best guess, and probably not in my stepdaughter's either.
The Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 1st of February, 2018. Agenda. The fight against climate change begins at home. This article by Climate and Energy Policy Officer at WWF Scotland, Sarah Beattie Smith. Across Scotland, more than a million homes are cold and drafty, wasting energy, wasting money, and contributing to climate change. Energy-inefficient homes keep more than one in four households in fuel poverty and add to our collective carbon emissions. Yet, the Scottish Government's consultation on a new fuel poverty strategy, which closes today, recommends deeply unambitious new targets for improving energy efficiency. The Government proposes to cut fuel poverty from nearly 27% of households today to less than 10% in 2040. Anyone who's spent a January evening wrapped up in blankets in their living room won't be volunteering to spend another 22 winters along that overlooked 10%. Living in a cold and drafty home means paying for the privilege of heating the air outside your homes, as it leaks out through the roof. The enormous amount of energy wasted by these leaky homes flies in the face of the government's own ambitions on climate change. Ahead of a new climate change bill expected in the spring, Climate Change Cabinet Secretary Rosanna Cunningham has said that the Scottish Government wants to increase our climate ambition while leaving no one behind. With our homes accounting for 13% of all the country's climate emissions, action to make our homes warmer will deliver significant climate wins, as well as lifting thousands of people out of fuel poverty. The social arguments for tackling poor energy efficiency and acting on fuel poverty are well known. Having a warmer, more energy-efficient home reduces your risk of health problems from respiratory illnesses and poor mental health, and would have immediate savings on energy bills. Not to mention the savings to the NHS of between £40 to £80 million a year. A national energy efficiency improvement programme would also create thousands of jobs, spread right across the country. But the environmental arguments for acting on energy efficiency are less frequently aired. Half of all the energy used in Scotland goes on heating buildings. With more than three quarters of our homes relying on gas for heating and hot water, the need to reduce the demand for this climate change-driving fossil fuel is urgent. Scotland is rightly famed for the positive story we have to tell on renewable energy. And whilst it's vital that we maintain momentum on the transition away from polluting fossil fuels towards clean, renewable energy, the need for the energy produced from either source will be reduced dramatically if Scotland can get it right on energy efficiency. By building new homes to much higher standards and by retrofitting older homes, we can significantly cut demand for energy and therefore cut the carbon footprint of Scotland's homes. Together with our other coalition partners, Stop Climate Chaos Scotland, We're calling on the Scottish Government to bring all homes up to a good standard of energy efficiency by 2025. Luckily, there are several unique opportunities available to the Scottish Government which would help them to achieve this, and to overcome the challenges posed by Scotland's cold and leaky housing stock. First, the new fuel poverty strategy, which will emerge following the current consultation, needs to set much more ambitious targets for eradicating fuel poverty and set strong minimum standards for the energy performance of our homes. Secondly, the upcoming Climate Change Bill is a chance to set strong targets for Scotland's energy efficiency programmes over the next 20 to 30 years. Finally, the Warm Homes Bill, due in Parliament in June, must drive forward action and investment that genuinely creates warm homes, rather than more warm words. We owe it to those people living in cold homes, and to the planet, to get this right. This article was by Climate and Energy Policy Officer for WWF Scotland, Sarah Beattie-Smith.
This article from the Herald Scotland, on the 1st of February 2018. Poem of the Day, New, by Rebecca Pine. This article by poetry editor Leslie Duncan. By the time February comes along, one should be totally organised and involved with the new. But things, of course, work out less tidily than that, as Rebecca Pine observes in her introductory poem from February and her poetry diary for 2018, when she produces From Argyle. New. The new year came, the new year went. When all our energies were bent on being full good intent and resolute. Alas, too soon resolve was spent. We ate the fruit. Whatever paper we may choose, what colour its politic hues, however singular its views, or smart its chat, will always pluralise the news. Now why is that? The bride wants something old and new, and something borrowed, something blue. A garter or perhaps a shoe. Surprise, surprise, there may not always be the view to prying eyes. Some say there's nothing new on earth, some say there's just a dreadful dearth. But I can say, for what it's worth, these lines, though few, have suffered all the pangs of birth. I'll swear they're new. This article by poetry editor Leslie Duncan.
This article from the Herald on Monday, the 29th of January 2018. Arts. Theatre Review, Bold Girls at Citizens Theatre, Glasgow. This article by Neil Cooper. Theatre, Bold Girls, Citizens Theatre, Glasgow, Neil Cooper, 4 stars. The photographic portrait on the wall of Marie's living room presents its smiling male subject as a picture of innocence in this revival of Rona Munro's 1990 Belfast set play, as the already fragile veneer of domestic calm comes crashing down once Marie's Saturday night with the girls takes a volatile turn it proves to be anything but. The catalyst for this is the arrival of a teenage girl dressed in white who lands on Marie's doorstep after making poetic reveries in the rain while bathed in the British Army searchlight from the helicopter overhead. This is Deirdre, who cuckoos her way into the fold as Marie. Her pal Cassie and Cassie's mum Nora keep up the tragicomic pretense that everything's okay. This is despite living in the occupied war zone of the Northern Irish Troubles, with assorted menfolk either incarcerated in Long Kesh, or in the case of Michael, the man in the photograph, and Marie's husband, dead. All 4 women look to different ways of surviving the crossfire they're caught in, grabbing after simple pleasures and pretending everything's all right. Richard Barron's stately production navigates its way through the everyday mundanity of the women's lives on Neil Haynes' vividly observed living room set, with an easy naturalism broken at points by out-front monologues from each of the women. At its heart are a quartet of beautifully realised performances from Deirdre Davis as Nora, Scarlett Mack as Cassie, Sinead Sharkey as Deirdre, and Lucianne McAvoy's heart-rending turn as Marie. With the women pushed to extremes, there are no sentimental displays of solidarity here, only a quiet desperation and a steely will to survive. When Sunday morning comes, Marie, Deirdre and the others may still only have crumbs of life, but they'll get by as they always have. This article by Neil Cooper.
End of Side 1. Please fast forward to the end of the tape and turn over for side 2.